You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by 818 Tequila, delicious and smooth tequila, made in harmony with the earth. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
Welcome to Dyed Green on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Kate McCabe.
I'm Max Sussman. This week's guest is Aisling Rogerson, founder of the famed Fumbly Cafe in Dublin. Fumbly is a place where you can get lunch. It's a place where you can meet a friend. It's a place where you can get a coffee. It's really a multi-purpose community space. And I think that's what's excited us about it so much, is that it's really kind of what we, when we talk about the third place, which is this thing that is ever elusive, it really seems to actually be that, you know?
And what is this thing that's ever elusive?
Well, the idea behind the third place is that restaurants and cafes sort of serve this really important role. So, you know, the way cities are organized, it seems like everything has this hyper-specific purpose. It's either work or school or, you know, a bank or some place where transactions happen, and the ability to sit and meet a friend or sort of have spontaneous meetings occur, are the spaces where that can happen are super limited. So, you know, thinking about what happens in restaurants and cafes and coffee shops as serving this really important role. I don't really know what the first two places are. I think it's work and home.
That was going to be my next question.
Home. Yeah.
What is the first place and what is the second place? You know, another thing that I think is really cool about the Fumbly is that it is a place where you can go as a tourist when you're visiting Dublin, and you can sit down next to local people. So it's not just a place that is overrun by tourists. You know, it is a shared space, but it's also welcoming to tourists.
Another thing that I think is super interesting about Fumbly is how, like, a lot of people have worked there, and a lot of people have worked there that now are either chefs in their own right or have started food businesses on their own. You know, I think it's cool how that happened sort of organically there. And now you hear about a lot of places that are starting up, and they're calling themselves incubators. But then when you, like, look a little deeper, you're like, well, what are you really incubating here? Like, it seems like you're just incubating your own sort of real estate income, for lack of a better.
Good point.
And so I think it's actually really cool how that happened at Fumbly, as mainly just as a result of them creating a really good place to work, not having, I think probably the most important thing would be, like, not having a very hierarchical kitchen brigade system. So people can
Absolutely.
Really learn from each other and get to be creative in a good working environment. And that kind of creates that incubation type atmosphere in reality.
Yeah. I mean, it's the intention and the purpose behind it. And I think that's something that a lot of places strive to be, but you can't fake it. You
yeah.
really can't fake it. And I think that's, if more places were like the Fumbly, we wouldn't be experiencing the staff shortages that a lot of restaurants are experiencing these days.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point.
They can be really shitty places to work.
Yeah. And it's like, maybe that's why you're having the shortage, because nobody wants to work for you. They're all working for other places.
Perhaps.
Let's not go there right now.
No. We'll save that for a later episode.
Yeah. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we hope you enjoy our interview with Aisling Rogerson. So thanks for being on the show.
Oh, my pleasure.
So the first thing we wanted to talk about was the inspiration for Fumbly, how it started, and, you know, were there other projects you were looking at, either in Ireland or around the world, that led you to want to do something like that?
Yeah, so many. So the inspiration for to start at the very beginning, like, the Fumbly wasn't a planned thing necessarily. It was very much a coming together of two people, which was myself and Luca, like 15 years ago. And we had this idea that we wanted to open a little place in Dublin that was selling falafel, because at the time nobody was doing falafel in Dublin. It was just one of those little ideas that we had sitting over a pint saying like, man, someone should open a falafel joint in Dublin. And we were like, okay, like, let's do it. And then we, you know, we looked at each other and we were like, do you know how to make falafel? And we were like, no, do you? It was like, no. Okay, cool. So we just kind of set out on this little, little journey of a couple of years of gathering ideas, learning how to make falafel, and doing a lot of different things at festivals for like the guts of 4 years. And during that time, we had a number of different food stalls and trucks and stuff that we took around to different events. And we pretty much just any bit of money that we made in those 4 years, we spent on traveling to different places and bringing back ideas and bringing back inspiration. There was a lot of traveling that we did around Ireland. And then there was a lot, like we went to New York, we went to Sicily, Amsterdam, Paris, Barcelona, London, south of France. Like we just went all over the place for 4 years. And there was so much inspiration, whether it was like, you know, the kind of urban scene in Berlin at the time and all the amazing little independent coffee shops and stuff that were springing up like 15 years ago, or it was like rural Sicily and like meeting a farmer, you know, near Mount Etna and like eating arancini in Catania. And we just took so much of that home, and then also spent a lot of time traveling around Ireland, doing the festival scene in Ireland, but then also like staying with people like the Fergusons down in Gobeen in West Cork, and getting to know all the crew down in Ballymaloe, and just meeting loads of like farmers and producers in Ireland and getting so much inspiration from them as well. So like the Fumbly is a total mishmash of that international and homegrown influence and those years of traveling, yeah.
What is the Irish festival scene for those who are not familiar with it?
So like, it's pretty good. It's pretty banging. Like there's, I mean, like nowadays, God, I mean, obviously the last couple of years, everything's gone a bit askew, but like we were doing maybe like 6 or 7 big music festivals. And they could have been anything from, actually, we like our favorite ones were always the smaller ones, which might have been 2,000, 5,000 people kind of thing, up to like the Electric Picnic or Oxygen, which would have been over 50,000, I think, back then. Or, you know, it was the same. It was the same kind of festival scene as you guys would have over there. Same in the UK. A lot of the same like acts would be touring around. There'd always be like your Food Traders. It's definitely way more, from a food perspective, it's way more interesting now than it was back then. Back then there was a lot of like dodgy chipper vans selling just like really shit burgers and chips. And then there was a small handful of people doing interesting things. And we were kind of a part of them, but we were like somewhat on the fringes. We never used to get the good spots really, because like we weren't in that like big mafioso chipper van kind of scene. And like the festival scene right now is even better than it was back then. And in particular, like you've got even more food festivals and things in the mix now. There was amazing. I don't know if you know that Ballymaloe had a food festival for years, the Litfest down there. That was incredible. That was probably one of the best food festivals that this country has ever seen. And it ran for like 5 or 6 years. And then came to an end a couple of years before COVID hit.
So you spent several years traveling, and then you ended up in Dublin. Was that always the plan? And how did you end up in the neighborhood you ended up? And what was the context at the time and the environment like?
Yeah. So, I mean, we were both based in Dublin. Myself and Luca lived in Dublin. So while at the same time as we were doing all of those festivals and events and traveling around in our vans, we were also part-time running a cafe in Dublin in the Dublin Food Co-op. And so the Dublin Food Co-op was in an area of Dublin called Dublin 8, which is where the Fumbly is now. And back then it was like we were in the recession, and it was in a neighborhood that was pretty like, it was full of old warehouses that were just empty. Some of them were being occupied by artist studios and kind of different mixed use spaces, but a lot of them were still in use by like various different industry or just vacant. They were just vacant buildings. And then there was this square called New Market Square, which was in the middle of it all. And the co-op had taken on a building in there, maybe like 2 or 3 years before we kind of came on the scene. So maybe like 2005, 2006 or something like that. Yeah, so we were running the cafe in there part-time. And then also after one of our trips to New York, we got really inspired by the Brooklyn Flea Market, came back to Dublin, and a couple of our friends were doing a few different kind of markets and they were doing some car boot sales and stuff, but Dublin didn't at that time either have a really big flea market. And so we set up a flea market, which became the Dublin Flea Market with a friend of ours, Sharon Green. And so we were doing that, like that was like the 4 or 5 years precursor to the Fumbly. So those kind of three things, the festival, the cafe and the co-op and the Dublin Flea Market, they were all the recession years. And for us, they were just amazing. It was like, for what we were doing back then, it was like the best possible time for us to start a business because we were looking for empty spaces, blank spaces to just create something that we wanted to create with a low rent, which is what you get during a recession. And that's kind of how we found the Fumbly. The Fumbly was this, it was like a ground floor level of an apartment block that had never been rented out because the apartments had just been finished just as the recession was kicking in. So it had been vacant for like, I don't know, 7 or 8 years before we went to view it. And it was just a shell of a unit, nothing in there, no electrics, no nothing. And so we got a really good rent on it and we fitted it out. And loads of people were telling us, you are crazy to be going into this neighborhood. There's nothing around here. You know, there's nothing going on. It's on the corner of a really lovely lane, Fumbly Lane, but then also like a really busy, like dual carriageway, which is not that nice at all. You know, it's just like this thoroughfare of cars. But because, but it's just around the corner from where the Dublin Food Co-op is and where we were, so where we were running the cafe every weekend, where we were running the flea market on a monthly basis. And then we also had an office in this kind of mixed use artist space behind on Mill Street as well. And so we knew, like we were in this area and I lived in the area as well. I'd been living around the Liberties for like, I don't know, 8 years or so. So we knew that there was people there. Because we were in the fringes with all those people, you know, it was kind of like everyone was just hiding out in their little studios and whatever. And so we knew that they were there. But to most other people, it was like, there's nobody, you know, what are you talking about? There's nobody in this area. There's nothing here. You need to go into the center of town. But yeah, we went ahead and we did it and kind of proved them all wrong. There was another studios in the area called South Studios. There was a few other people who really were doing something in Dublin 8 at that time. And that kind of, I suppose, brought attention to the area. And then in that like massively unfortunate way that happens in every city in the world, it changes the area and then it suddenly becomes cool and it suddenly becomes expensive. And like Dublin 8 is now one of the more expensive parts of the city. And all of those vacant warehouse sites and all of those artist studios are now gone. The Dublin Food Co-op is gone. And it's all being redeveloped for hotels and office and yeah. It's kind of it's one of those ones. It's classic. It's the same as so many other cities and so many other areas.
Yeah, yeah. It's absolutely a familiar story, like everywhere.
How does that impact you as a business owner in that neighborhood? Does it make it harder to hire people, to find people who are like, do people have to come from further away to work there because they can't afford to live in the neighborhood? Or have you had to change anything that you do to sort of accommodate that?
No, I mean, like, luckily enough, no, what's going on in Dublin at the moment is like everywhere in Dublin is expensive. I think we're, you know, Dublin 8 definitely came out of an area that was really cheap and into a more expensive area. But it seems like the whole of Dublin is now kind of on a par with that. There's very few corners left that are affordable anymore. So in terms of people having to travel further, not necessarily. And Dublin's a pretty accessible city anyway. You know, everywhere is 15 minutes bike ride, or like, you know, 20 minutes of a bus ride. I feel like we're lucky in that we've managed to like maintain a sense of community where we are. And there's still, there's a huge sense of community still in this area, despite the fact that, you know, a lot of those older, the places that I'm talking about from 12, 15 years ago are gone. There's still a really amazing sense of community in Dublin 8. And we're still very much a part of that and at the heart of that. And we've got like really great regular customers. And yeah. I'm kind of forgetting what your original question was here. I think I've gone off on a tangent.
I think that's good. Yeah, I think that's good. Change tracks a little bit, you know, I wanted to talk about how one of the things that we're trying to do with the podcast and also with our tour company is to expand people's perceptions of what Irish food is. I think in the U.S., people mm-hmm. tend to think, you know, Guinness and potatoes, shepherd's pie, kind of some of those heavier potato-based, maybe more old-fashioned types of cuisine. And we saw that recently during the St. Patrick's Day festival, there was a panel discussion about, you know, whether or not Ireland had a national cuisine. And I was wondering if you could talk about how you see Irish food or how you would define it in 2022.
Hmm. Yeah, I missed that panel discussion. I would have liked to have heard that. What was the outcome of that?
It wasn't online, unfortunately.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Okay. We know everyone's talking about it, but
yeah, we actually hosted something like similar-ish a few years ago. We used to run a series of events called ITA, and as part of that, there was a panel discussion around like Irish food culture and pretty much the same kind of thing. Do we actually have our own indigenous food culture or not? For me, what Irish food really is about produce. And I like our culture per se, I think, is really about it's about the products. It's about dairy. It is about like meat production, whether fortunately or unfortunately. And I like what I feel is like the most overlooked part of it as well is like is our vegetable growing. It's we can produce such incredible, we can grow and produce such incredible produce on this island. And I think for me, like that's where our culture is, the quality of the produce that can be produced here. Whether what we do with that produce, we tend to take influence from all over the world. And in the more higher end restaurants, obviously like the whole kind of higher end restaurant scene, you know, since Noma kind of led the way for Nordic cuisine, everyone, like you can definitely make a meal out of like solely Irish ingredients. And it is just, you know, Irish food. But I wouldn't say that that's necessarily our food culture. I think our food culture is very much influenced from abroad. And I used to kind of rile against that and try and say like, no, but like, we've got to find what our indigenous culture is. And I spent years trying to focus in on that. And I think of, you know, in recent times, I'm like, no, it's okay. Like we've got, our culture is in the produce and in the growing and in the, you know, all the artisan producers who are dotted around the country doing what they're doing, whether it's curing meat or fish or just making different products. Like for me, that's where it's at.
I'm Chava Perivan, co-host of Agave Road Trip on HRN, here to talk about 818 Tequila. 818 creates their tequila using traditional methods at a family-owned and operated distillery in Jalisco, Mexico. From the blue agave they grow to their recycled glass bottle, 818 emphasizes the earth's importance in all they do. Their distillery runs on biomass and solar power, which means they don't rely as much on fossil fuels and are able to reduce their carbon footprint. Their labels, corks, and boxes are all certified by the Forest Stewardship Council as coming from sustainability-managed forests. 818 is a proud member of 1% for the Planet, through which they support HRN as well as Sacred, my organization in Jalisco, where together we transform agave byproducts and water waste into adobe bricks that are donated to local infrastructure projects, like a local library in Zapotitlán de Vadillo. Visit drink818.com to learn more about their sustainability efforts and find 818 near you. 818 has been part of so many magical nights for me, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
What led you to sort of change your opinion on that in terms of, you know, the evolution you just described about Irish cuisine needing to be rooted in Ireland versus incorporating other influences? I'm curious about that shift.
Yeah, I'm curious about it too. God, let's unpack that one a bit. I think like part of it was like a real desire to try and find this thing that like I've got such a love for and a passion for and a connection to, which is food and eating and sharing food around a table with people and going traveling around the world and being a part of that culture in other places around the world and really feeling how strong it is in terms of like Italian food culture or like French or Spanish or even like North African, and kind of feeling like, you know, oh no, we must, feeling like, I don't know if we have that in Ireland. And then thinking like, oh no, we must, we've got to be able to find that. It's got to be there. So I think it came from a place of like a desire of wanting it to be there and wanting it to be true. But then the reality is that, you know, maybe it wasn't there. And that but it doesn't matter. We've got other things. Like our history is like, we're an agricultural country. We're farming based. There was a lot of poverty in Ireland and people ate really basic food. It wasn't fine dining. It wasn't fine cuisine until very recently. And that's okay as well, you know? And there's all of the, like what we did have was, you know, a culture of dairy products like milk, cheese, bread making, meat and fish curing. So those kind of things. And I think like, I've just come to celebrate the simplicity of those things a little bit more, rather than trying to find this like all-encompassing food culture that, you know, maybe just was never there in the first place.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. One of the things that we have noticed as we've been exploring, there are a lot of international chefs, people from other places who have moved to Ireland and are doing really incredible things and are interpreting their own regional cuisines using the really special dairy and meat and produce that you mentioned in Ireland. It's really interesting the way that the political history of Ireland and the history of emigration and immigration is really kind of combining to make something, I think, very special and unique in the food world in general.
Mm.
I think what you're saying is really interesting in terms of, you know, wanting something to be there that's not necessarily there, but then at the same time realizing that there is something there that is really special. The way you put it, I think, is really interesting. And even in a lot of the older, more traditional Irish cookbooks, there are so many things with dairy that are, yeah, like there's like 8 kinds of buttermilk style drinks that are made, and they all have a, yes, different name and a different tradition and a different style. So I think that is actually really fascinating. Culinary history,
but like so few of them are actually made anymore.
Right.
You know, can we still see remnants of that in our food culture today? Not really. There's a small amount of them, and I think what is worth celebrating today is not necessarily the stuff that was there in the past, which sets it aside from a culture like an Italian food culture, where literally you've been having like a risotto that has been made in the same way for like 300 mm-hmm. years, you know. For us, I would say if we were to compare an Irish food product in that way, it would be some of our cheeses and some of our like meat or fish curing, but it's a limited mm-hmm. pot, you know.
Well, one of the things that, Kate, maybe you remember, I can't remember who said it on one of our interviews, but that, you know, Irish culture and cuisine for many, many years was defined by people leaving the country. And more recently, it's been partially at least defined by people coming to the country from different parts of the world. So, and I thought that was a really interesting contrast.
Yeah. And I would even add into that, like, so much of our food culture now is like Irish people who left in like the 80s or 90s or the noughties, and who went and worked abroad or lived abroad, and are coming back with all of this influence and this passion from what they experienced overseas, and are coming back over and applying that, you know, techniques and recipes and different things to the produce that can be found here and that's grown and produced on this
island. Yeah, that's so cool. We wanted to talk about Fumbly as a place of community as well, and not just, you know, obviously that's closely related to food, but it's a gathering place and a center of sorts. Was that always the intention? Did that develop organically? And has that been something that you've worked to maintain, you know, the whole time it's been open?
Yeah, it was definitely at the fore for when we opened up. And to be honest, it was kind of even more at the fore than food was. Like, what me and Luca really wanted to do was open a place for all of our friends and all of that community that I was talking about that was in Dublin 8. It was a place for them to go, because there wasn't anything there at the time. So I would almost say, yeah, like, firstly, it was a meeting place, and then it was about the food. And those two different things have kind of vied with each other at different points over the years. You know, sometimes the food comes into first place, and then other times another community focus is more at the fore. Both of them are definitely up there at the top, and have been there since the very beginning. It has been hard for sure to maintain that community focus in the Fumbly at times. And ironically, but I'm sure there's lots of other people who would say the same thing, that like the pandemic was something that completely brought back in that community focus. I mean, it was the only thing that we could do for a year and a half, was just only be focused on our local community. Definitely the couple of years prior to the pandemic, like, we had gotten really well known. There was like a lot of tourists who were coming in every day and weekends. Like, we would see all of our regular locals in kind of like on weekdays, and then they wouldn't come near us on the weekend, because the weekend was just like overrun with the tourists and the day trippers. And we're starting to see that come back, and we are really, really, really welcoming of that. Like, it was definitely the one really nice thing about the Fumbly was that balance, that if you are a tourist and you're visiting the city, like, you're coming in and you're very much sitting like shoulder to shoulder with the people from the local area. And there, it's a real mix of people in the Fumbly always as well. It's like, there's artists and there's the people from the creative communities, and there's people from the corporate world, and there's a family sitting over there and someone having a cup of tea with their granny. And like, it's a real mix all the time.
What kind of changes did the pandemic lead to, specifically in terms of what did you do and how did it lead to sort of regaining that community space sense? I have heard other people say the same thing, but, you know, the challenge would be, how do you build community when people can't physically gather together? What did you do to make that happen?
People queuing outside.
Yeah.
That's where it was, literally like in those first few weeks, because we very, very quickly turned ourselves into a shop. So when we were told that we couldn't trade anymore as a cafe, at that time, we were currently running a small like farmer's market in the stables. So the Fumbly Stables is another building that's just right next door to the cafe, which is also a big part of the Fumbly now. The Fumbly is not just the cafe anymore. It really is the Fumbly and the Fumbly Stables. And the stables is kind of like our event space and our cultural building, and where we do a lot of workshops and education-based events and things like that. But so we were running a very small market in there, which we've been running for about a year. And so when all the restrictions came in, we just kind of moved the market, like from one week to the next, we moved the market into the shop area. And and the producers who were there and still able to travel and get to us, they kind of came in. And for the next couple of weeks, we were trading like 2 or 3 days a week in the shop, but with all the producers from the market. And we were kind of one of the only places in the area that were doing that. So we kind of very quickly became this meeting point still for everyone, but it was more like they were meeting and having chats in the queue outside and then being told they could go in ones and twos into the shop and, you know, doing their shopping and then leaving again, but then coming back like the next day or 2 days later, because it was the only time that they were leaving their houses. And then that was when those really first, like really harsh restrictions were in place. And then things started to ease up and we were able to open a little bit more. We basically stayed operating as a shop. The kind of the market element of it kind of waned out and we just started adding in more produce. We started importing our own organic vegetables and we just made more contact with some local growers and just got in their produce and we were just selling them ourselves on more days a week. So it turned more into a shop than a market. And then I guess we were just still that kind of meeting place for people in the neighborhood.
So now at this point, do you see a lot of that carrying through or will you be planning to return to the format you had before as a cafe? Will it be a hybrid? Like what's going to happen?
Yeah, we're currently a hybrid half shop, half cafe. And I mean, that was something last year, whenever we were allowed to put seats back in and operate as a cafe, we did. And we just did it really slowly because we had built up the shop and we had kind of had a bit of fun doing it. It was almost like, you know, out of necessity came this opportunity to do something differently and to just work in a different way. It was like we got stripped right back down to the basics and we were building ourselves back up again. But we were able to change all the little systems and things that we were like, oh, well, that wasn't working anyway. So let's just change that and let's try and, you know, be something different for a while. And so when we were allowed to become a cafe again, we decided, actually, you know what, we kind of like what we're offering here now in terms of all the local produce. And for once, all the kind of people that we were working with who were making amazing products that we would put on our menus, we were now able to present to people in the shop, and all the like incredible vegetables that are grown by people like McNally's and Riversfield and Elmhurst and things. We could have like all of their vegetables on display and for everyone to get any day of the week. So yeah, we just decided we were going to keep it. And so we're now this hybrid scenario that we are sticking with for the moment. And it's really nice. And we get really positive feedback from people. Like even now at the moment, we're seeing people coming back in who we haven't seen like in over 2 years. You know, we're only just still coming out of the pandemic. You know, we're not fully out of it yet. And so there's familiar faces who are coming back in and they're just giving us such lovely feedback by saying that the place just feels really nice. The atmosphere is lovely and it's still what it used to be, but it has this kind of added element now of all of the fresh produce. We still have to tweak the business model a little bit. That's the tricky part, but we're getting there.
It's my understanding, beyond just being a great cafe in a community space, that you've also sort of operated, maybe not intentionally, but kind of as a training ground for up and coming chefs in the Dublin area. I think there's been a lot of people that have worked for you that have gone on to do their own really cool food projects. Can you talk a little bit about that? Was that sort of intentional or is that just kind of the way that things go when you're a really cool, homegrown, exciting business?
It definitely wasn't intentional. I don't think you can set out to have such an amazing alumni of staff. Like I almost look at it in the opposite direction. I'm like, wow, how lucky we were that all of these amazing people who are now doing wonderful things just happened to have worked for us at one point, you know. But I am aware that it's a two-way street. Like both, you know, definitely we've had some really incredible people working with us who are now doing amazing things, like Katie Sanderson and Jasper O'Connor, who have the White Mouse product range, Harry Colley, who's doing Harry's Nut Butter. There's Laura Colwell, Keith Coleman, Sinead Moclair. Who am I forgetting? I mean, there's so many like really incredible chefs who have gone on to do wonderful things. I don't know what exactly it was. I mean, there's definitely something in the way that we run our kitchen that is, so we've always kind of approached it from a non-hierarchical structure. I don't even like using the word non-hierarchical because it kind of like there is always like unspoken hierarchy in any sort of systematic working environment. But it's a circular kitchen. It basically means that like everyone is working together with the same amount of responsibility, and they move around the kitchen in different roles rather than moving up and down a ladder of hierarchy. What this allows for is a huge amount of creative input from everyone. It's not just a head chef who's saying like, okay, this is what we're doing today and you're going to execute these dishes. Like everyone has an input into the menus on a daily basis and everyone shares responsibility. And you're really thrown into the deep end sometimes. It is definitely not an imperfect, it's definitely not a perfect system. It has its imperfections, like big time. But I think the kind of like what that atmosphere and what that kind of freedom that we give to the chefs creates in a way is a fast track for them to figure out what it is that they truly want to do. Because we kind of give them the space to do that, but within the kind of safety net of the Fumbly. It's like, hey, you want to do something? You want to put something on the menu? Absolutely go and do it. And like, you know, your pal over there is going to be doing something next week, and they buzz off each other. That's partly to do with it. I mean, I think there's also something to be said for, you know, the synergy and energy of something that is like when you're so passionate about something and then you attract other people who are passionate, and then that whole, you know, that passion and that energy just creates something really special together. And it's kind of self-perpetuating and self-feeding. And that was for years, that's always been the way. And it's still there now, but we definitely got wobbled off that by the pandemic for sure. And it's very difficult, as in, I believe the rest of the world at the moment, it's very difficult to find chefs, and it's very difficult to kind of, I suppose, tempt people into the industry, which is unfortunately still an underpaid and overworked industry. We do our best in terms of work-life balance, and you know, our chefs only work a four-day week, and despite all the freedom and creativity and things that they get, like, it's still a hard place to work. And I think there's a new wave of chefs that are going to be coming in. But it's going to take a couple of years to get back up to that level of, I suppose, the experience and the skill that was there post or pre-pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting, and to think about the context in which you started off in terms of the recession and the community of artists that was around compared to now, and to note that a lot of the alumni that you mentioned went on to do non-restaurant food projects. And I was just in general wondering if you thought, like, you know, what's the climate now? Do you think that someone could start a similar project in a different city now? Or do you think the climate, maybe the real estate prices or the labor market, you know, is it too hard to do now? Do you think this is something that was a once in a generation project? Or do you think that, something like it could emerge similarly now?
When you say projects, you mean like the Fumbly?
Yeah, totally.
Okay. I think it can totally be done anywhere, in any city, in any part of the world. It comes down to the people, and it comes down to the passion, and it comes down to the desire to create something together with other people. And that can be done, you know, no matter where you are in the most expensive city in the world, in which Dublin currently is, you will always find the nook or cranny that you need to find if what you want to do is truly like what you want to do and you're super passionate about it. Yeah, I think it's more of an attitude thing rather than an economic or a, yeah. I mean, that's not denying it definitely is harder now to find places with affordable rent. But there's also other ways of doing things. I think it might force people to go into more kind of collaborative projects that aren't necessarily, you know, so profit driven or something. I don't know. There's got to be a whole new way of feeding people that emerges in the next few years. You know, I think anyway, pre-pandemic, like, we were kind of hitting the saturation point of restaurants and the restaurant scene and the kind of, you know, top 10 lists and all this kind of stuff. You know, let's go back to basic guides and let's just, you know, sit down around a table and have a meal together and let's feed people and let's bring nourishment and health into that, you know, as well. And enjoyment and laughter. And it doesn't all have to be about being on a list and being seen in a place, the new place in town or whatever. And I think that there's ways from a business model perspective, I think that there's ways to go about that will be able to get around the, you know, the kind of like rising rents in cities and those other kind of issues. We just actually started last year, I mean, in the middle of the pandemic, God knows how, but we somehow managed to introduce a profit share system into the company, which was something that we've been talking about for a number of years. And we finally did it last year. And actually just a couple of weeks ago, we just handed out our first share of the profits to our staff, which just felt so amazing. And I kind of like, that's where it's those kind of things that I would love to put my energy into now over the next, if we're still here in another decade's time, I feel like that's the really important stuff alongside, you know, the produce and maintaining those relationships with suppliers and offering the chefs and the staff the opportunities, you know, to kind of grow and be their best selves as well.
We were wondering if you could share, you know, any more about your long-term vision and what's next and, you know, what the next evolution is going to look like.
We had a vision that we wrote down in 2019 as well that, yeah, I should go and look back over that. I'd say, I don't know, I can't even remember what it says now because it's literally like just the last 2 years have just completely changed everything, you know? Also, like a big thing that happened just in the last year is my business partner, Luca, has moved back to Tuscany, to Italy, where he's from. And so that kind of changes things as well. And there's a little bit of unknown and a little bit of uncertainty around, okay, well, you know, where are we going to be now in 5 or 10 years' time? I know that we've just signed another lease for the Fumbly. So we're here, you know, we're definitely signed up and ready to go. But I think for me, again, one of those like blessings in disguise from the pandemic, it really refocused my attention on that sense of community. And going back to basics. And also maybe like to go back to what we started talking about at the beginning, like, you know, moving away from that kind of, you know, drive towards haute cuisine and trying to find the perfect Irish meal and all this kind of stuff. And really just going back down to like, what's really important is sitting around a table and sharing a meal with friends and family. And it's so easy to get sidetracked from that simple thing, you know, and so many restaurants and so many cafes do get sidetracked from it, even though it's, I think, at the heart of every cafe owner, that's where they're at. They're really driven to open their businesses because there's something so beautiful about just cooking for people and being part of that enjoyment. And I think if we can maintain that sense of community and sense of connection to food, and two, are maintaining the relationships that we have with our local suppliers, who also feed into that sense of community as well. Like that's kind of, if we can still be doing that in another 10 years' time, in a very true sense that feels right, I think that's where the success is. I think we've achieved a lot in the last 10 years, and to just still be here in another 10. That's what it's about, you know. I mean, it's a hard enough industry to still be going after 10 years, and I think sustaining a business in the food world is one of the most difficult things. And I suppose my vision would be just about that, and kind of honing in on the smaller things instead of I'm really going back down to basics and into the internal and the smaller, rather than trying to expand or get bigger. It's more about focusing in on the personal, you know, relationships with customers and suppliers and the well-being of our staff, expanding things like the profit share and other kind of internal structures within the company that can help benefit more people who are working with us.
Great. Amazing. Well, thank you so much for being on the show and for talking to us today. This is really great.
No, you're very welcome. Thanks for asking me on.
Absolutely.
Dyed Green is a project of Bog and Thunder, whose mission is to highlight the best of Irish food and culture through food tours, events, and media. Find out more at bogandthunder.com.
We'd love to hear from you. If you have any story suggestions, questions, or things you'd like to share in response to our broadcast, you can email us directly at dyedgreen@heritageradionetwork.org.
This show is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.